speak about continuum limit and renormalization in loop quantum gravity.
Hello, everybody. I'm going to talk about continuum limit and renormalization in LQG. I know it's April Fool's Day, and this talk is unfortunately not a joke, which means I really have to give it. Let's go to the next slide, first slide. It's a review talk, and it was essentially Abhay that asked me to give an overview of what is going on in simple model and LQG continuing the continuum. And I tried to escape giving such a talk, but I find it an interesting exercise, and I hope you will too. So it's really a review talk. I'm not going to propose any fundamental solutions. I'm going to give some directions, but I'm going to review what are the main methods that we can use to address this problem. Essentially, there are going to be two types of methods, the renormalization group methods and summation methods. Along the way, I'll try to clear some myths and some confusions that is embedded into this quest and this thing. And I hope I will not create new confusion. This is a non-technical talk, so for people who are used to my talks, there's a very low number of equations. It's mostly a conceptual talk or review talk. And in each slide, if you find the slides too busy, I ask you to check for bullet points. So I try to have no more than one bullet point per slide. And that's going to be the main message of this slide. So let's move to the next slide. So in this talk, I will not talk about the continuum limit in general, but I will just only present the issue of the continuum limit from the point of view of a thin foam model. One last thing I wanted to say is that I'm welcoming questions, but any questions that have the sense of a discussion, I will postpone it to a discussion part. So, okay, for non-specialists, what are thin foam models? In a nutshell, thin foam models are quantum amplitudes where the boundary states are labeled by spin networks. And the networks are graphs with edges are labeled by representations of the group. And I, since I'm going to talk about 4D gravity, you can think of this representation as being SU2 representation. And then nodes are labeled by invariant maps of these representations or intertwined. So that's the boundary state. The bulk of a spin foam is the color two-dimensional complex. So on the right-hand side, you have what locally a two-dimensional complex is made of. It's, obtained by gluing faces along edges, and then these edges meet along vertices. And then we have a coloring, which is induced by the boundary coloring, which is that the faces carry the spin, and the edges carry an intertwiner. Next slide. So when we talk about spin foam models, we can be very creative in the type of spin foam models we construct. We exclusively talk about local spin foam models. That is, a spin foam model which are characterized only by a weight which is carried by the one vertex. Such spin foam models are characterized by a vertex amplitude, an edge amplitude, and a phase weight. We can always reabsorb the edge amplitude into the vertex amplitude. So essentially, a local spin foam model is characterized by a vertex amplitude, which is in AZ, which depends on the spin of the faces that make up the vertex. It depends also on the intertwiners. And now the phase weight is also a very important part of the definition of the model. It depends on the spin that the phase carries. And the spin foam model is defined by taking a local product over every vertices, or vertex amplitude, a product every phase, over every phase of the phase weight, and then summing over spin and intertwiners. One thing is that we spend lots of time usually talking about the vertex amplitude, but you have to remind yourself that the choice of the phase amplitude is extremely important into determining what are the divergence or convergence properties of the spin foam model. So for instance, for any vertex amplitude, you can always choose a phase amplitude which makes the spin foam convergent or divergent. So all these issues about infinity is already hidden in the choice of the phase amplitude that we have maybe in general less control on. Next slide. So let's go to the core of the problem. Is that a spin foam model?
Laura,
Laura, just a clarification. What was gamma and what was S in the previous transparency? Because it comes up
again. In the whole talk, gamma is, let's go back to the previous slide, spin four models. I said spin four models, thank you for the clarification. It's characterized by a spin network, gamma. So gamma represents the spin network. Okay, and S represents the two-dimensional complex. Okay? So when we define the spin from amplitude, it depends on the boundary spin network we choose, this boundary graph, gamma, but it also depends on the two-dimensional complex we use to interpolate between this boundary gamma. Is that clear? Okay. So,
yes, thank you.
So a spin-four model depends on two types of different data, discrete data. And these data are so let's go back to the slide called bulk and boundary. So a spin-four model depends on two types of discrete data. A boundary data, which is a boundary graph, which is a discrete data, contains edges and vertices. And then a bulk discrete object, which is a two-dimensional complex. Okay? So a priori, it means that there are two types of continuum limit that we could consider, right? There is the one which I think is the real continuum limit I'm going to argue, which is the bulk continuum limit, where in some sense we want to refine or sum or, you know, get rid of this bulk two-dimensional complex. And we're going to talk about different techniques, whether it's refinement, normalization group, group phi theory, perturbative expansion. And then we could also take a boundary continuum limit, which is that we might want also to refine the boundary graph. So these two limits are not independent, in the sense that if you refine the boundary data, you also have to refine the bulk data, but they are different limits. And that's a very important point, so a very important difference between spin-four models and a usual lattice gauge, lattice model. So let's go to the next slide. So let me focus first on this boundary state. And let me, emphasize one. The point is that the main point here is to say that the spin-four model is fundamentally different in principle from a usual lattice model or you know, a dynamical triangulation model. Okay. So it means that, you know, even if we can borrow in practice some ideas or techniques from these objects, we have to be aware of the fundamental difference. So one of these differences that I'm going to explain now is the fact in a lattice model, we cannot, let's say when we have, let's say, fixed square lattice, we cannot take the bulk continuum limit without taking the boundary continuum limit, right? Because they are kind of the same limit. But in a spin-four model, a priori, we can. So the idea behind that is that it is possible to have a continuum theory, for instance, like the theory of rotation, which is labeled by a discrete basis of state. Right, you don't break the continuum nature of the theory by choosing a particular basis of state, for instance, rotations and the state limits. Now, let's go to the next slide, and let me make this statement more precise. Let's assume that for some reason, magically, somebody comes and we finally found a way to take the bulk continuum. That is, we found a way to have, and I'm going to talk about techniques. So let's assume that we have a way to somehow define the amplitude I talked about, the spin from amplitude Z gamma S, and then remove the dependence on the two complex, and end up with an amplitude which is Z gamma. Now, suppose that we manage to do that in a consistent manner, and I'm going to explain what I mean by that, and that we obtain this Z gamma for any SU2 boundary spin network state. And let's also assume that this amplitude, which is the bulk continuum amplitude, is such that when I restrict this amplitude to a spin network where one of the spins vanish, then this amplitude is exactly the same as the one where I evaluate this amplitude on a graph where the edge is contracted, okay? This object would be a continuum definition of the theory, okay? This is a very important point. The reason lies in the Hasekawa-Lewandowski theorem. The Hasekawa-Lewandowski theorem tells us that the continuum Hilbert space for gravity can be defined as the projective limit of the spin network Hilbert space. So that means that embedded spin networks are the complete basis of the continuum hybrid. So if you know the amplitude for a complete basis, then you know the full amplitude. And one point of technicality here is about the embedded spin networks. And in spin foam, there is a natural way in which spin networks come with an embedded. Let's go to the next slide.
Question.
The so-called bulk continuum limit. Yes?
Question. Yes, when you have the amplitude defined just as a function of the boundary spin network, is that embedded and up to diffeomorphisms of the boundary or not yet mining out by diffeomorphisms of the boundary?
Well, this amplitude should implement diffeomorphism of the boundary if it's the physical amplitude. Okay? So this amplitude will have kernels that should represent the symmetry of the system. So here you're asking what type of conditions should I have on this continuum amplitude? Okay? And yes, that's one of the conditions. But the point here is that, you know, you can have a continuum amplitude labeled by this picture. Okay? Okay, there's a question here. Yes. Okay, so let's move to,
Could you repeat the question,
point,
please?
The point here is that there might be other discrete bases of states which are also convenient. I don't... Can we move? Yeah. Yeah, there could be other discrete bases of states. Here for this token...
The question,
though,
because couldn't hear the question.
Let's move to the, let's say, the second part of bulk continuum limit.
Could you repeat the question, please? We couldn't hear it.
Suppose we have such an amplitude labeled by this, which depends on all possible graphs. Okay. Will that solve? The claim is that this would be, and maybe this is not the only way, you know, to present the amplitude. There might be more convenient basis than the entire remark. Would that solve the? You know, this would be a continuum definition of the theory. Now. Even if I have a continuum definition of the theory, would that solve all the problems of the theory? Like, would that allow me to compute the graviton propagator? And the answer is no. In order to compute the graviton propagator, we would need to understand what is the overlap between the network basis, as devised by Hasekar Lewandowski, and the graviton basis, right? So it means the n graviton state should come as an overlap of, you know, written here formally here. And since one state, the graviton state, is some kind of local state and the other one is not, this overlap necessarily would in general involve an infinite number of superpositions. So if you really want to, you know, even if you have a continuum definition of theory, getting out the graviton propagation from there is still, you know, another work, but it's a different type of work. It's a kinematical type of work, which is relating the one type of boundary basis to another. Okay, and this, you know, this amplitude A and gamma could be, as sometimes people assume, sharply placed in the classical. Okay, so in order to conclude, let's move to the next slide. The discussion here, which is called truncation versus discretization, the discussion we just had here is a discussion about the fact that there is a fundamental difference between discretization and truncation. So let me give an example. If I take QCD on a finite like this, this is a discretization, in the sense that this is an approximation of the theory and nobody believes that it has anything to do with an exact evaluation. Now, if we take another type of theory, we take massive quantum field theory, but we use boundary state, but truncated such that the external number of legs is finite, so truncated to a finite number of external particles. This one is a truncation, and it is fundamentally different from the discretization. A truncation So discretization is an approximation. Truncation is not an approximation in the sense that if you know you knew all the n particle space with where n is the external leg of a given theory, then essentially you know the continuum limit of the theory. You know the theory exactly. Now, in practice, so a truncation is an exact evaluation in a discrete. Now, in practice, the truncation is useful when it is related to an approximation. So usually, you know, we never really evaluate the endpoint particle exactly. What we do is that we evaluate this in a perturbative extension. And then we can show, let's say, in a massive theory, what's interesting is that if you fix the number of particles and the number of, and the total energy, then essentially you can show that by truncating or by doing a perturbative expansion at a given order within a truncation, that is keeping all the external legs, you know, at a finite order, you're making a small mistake. Okay? So what's useful about the truncation is that in principle it can give a continuum definition, and in practice, if it satisfies certain extra conditions, it could be used as an approximation, like perturbative expansion. So for instance, in usual field theory, if we have, in the massive case, then the number of particles is a useful truncation. In the massless case, it is a useless truncation. That is, even if you truncate the number of external particles to be finite, then no matter how low the energy, the inside the state, you know, an infinite number of particles will always contribute. This is the infrared problem. Okay? So, now this allow me to distinguish these two discrete data, right? So in principle, the boundary graph gamma is a truncation. Okay? But now the bulk too complex is a discretization. This is the main point. Now, the LQG hope, in some sense, is that the spin network truncation in gravity might be akin to a particle number truncation in massive field theory. That is, it may be, you know, that is, in some sense, the hope is that somehow this truncation in terms of boundary spin networks might lead to useful approximation. Whether this is true or not is, you know, one of the biggest, I think, open problem there. But I think it's good to somehow spell out why we like this network data. Okay, so now let's move to the next slide, which is the real problem. Once we say that the boundary states are a truncation, and then we hope to use maybe this truncation in a useful manner, the main issue here is really not about the boundary, it's about the part. So the question is whether we can find a description, a prescription to define the continuum limit of this amplitude Z gamma S, where gamma is boundary state and S is the true complex. So here, by continuum limit, I mean some kind of procedure that allows us to get rid of the dependence of this amplitude on the true complex, and a way to define a true complex independent set of amplitudes. So, you know, finding a way to go from Z gamma S to something that depends only on Z gamma, only on the boundary. A condition also is that somehow this procedure should also agree with some kind of semi-classical limit. That is, in the limit where I send h bar to zero, this amplitude for the boundary state, Z gamma, should approach exponential is of gamma, where S, Hg of gamma is the Hamilton-Jacobi functional for the boundary state, you know, the boundary metric labeled by gamma. So in order to formulate, for instance, the second condition, you need to be able to understand what is the correspondence between a graph gamma and the boundary metric, and there has been lots of work in this direction. I'm not going to talk about that. I'm going to focus in this talk only about the first problem. So in principle, a continuum limit is a procedure which should lead us to the possibility to find all the spin network correlators. Okay. Now, this might be too ambitious, and you know, in general, you might want to come to have a milder condition that maybe you want to be able to consider continuity that, you know, in the perturbative setting where somehow the coupling you're using to perturb should be identified with physical operators. Okay, but for the sake of this talk, this is what I mean. Just let's, you know, procedure to get rid of this, the complex dependence. So now we could argue, and maybe not everybody is convinced that we should look for a continuum unit or a bulk continuum unit. Maybe, you know, we have a preferred model, and then you know, we want to assign reality to this Z gamma S and understand the dependence in the vertex. So let me go to the next slide called spin form factory. And trying to convince you that in fact you have to take this continuum no matter what. So one reason would be the following. So unlike, you know, three dimension, if we look at four dimension, we have we have been very successful, and there's been a variety of models that have been proposed. So, you know, the one we first proposed in series, and then the Lorentzian implementation of EPRL, and then there's a nice version of Dupuy-Levin based on generalized Korean states, or Ricci Baratin based on the flux population, Alexandrov from the Hamiltonian, Wieland on some more, you know, continuum spinorial formulation, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. There's a few more, I'm sure even some I have proposed that I have not included yet. So now the main point here is that in fact, okay, the reason that we have so many models is that in principle it's just possible to propose an infinite number of such models that satisfy the simplicity constraint. Okay, so the reason for that is more or less simple. It's the fact that in fact all the models that have been proposed implement more or less in some way, we start from SO4BF theory, and then we implement in some way the semi-classical, the classical simplicity constraint. Okay. So now all these models technically can be constructed like that. So let me look at this, you know, spin form models which are built out of which are triangulation models for simplicity. Okay. So essentially, the all these models, what they have in common is that we start from, let's say, a classical tetrahedral, which is called T on the left. And then we find some kind of coherent state. So by coherent state, I mean a map that maps T into a state phi of T. And this state phi of T is an element of the interfinal space of four representations of the shape. Okay? So you give me such a map, and there's many such maps. Any map like that would be called the Korean state. And then we find an extension of this map labeled by tetrahedra to the space of interfinals of vector 4. So we're going to talk about only Euclidean for the world. Okay, anytime you have such a map, which is essentially a coherent state satisfying the simplicity constraint, then you define the amplitude to be the trace of the tensor product of such map. And then to define the model, you have to choose a type of measure, could be a continuum measure or a discrete measure on the space of classical tetrahedra. Okay? And all the models that we have so far are, you know, of this kind. Okay? So all these models are somehow associated with some type of preferred coherent state. And then on this coherent state, because you have a preferred representation of the classical geometry, you implement the simplicity constraint. This is the second map. Okay, so, but clearly here, you know, I could every day I could start and choose a different phi hat and then propose a different model. Okay, so it means that there are really an infinite number of some models. Some models are mathematically preferable, and you know we are studying them, and I think it's valid, and we could, you know, we can add some, you know, mathematical properties that we like, but that doesn't mean that they are physically distinguished. Next slide. So the slide called non-renormalizability. So now all these models that I've just described here, which is, you know, an infinite number of them, differ by some kind of discretization ambiguity. In fact, they differ by how am I going to represent the simplicity constraint at the discrete level in this quantum state. Okay. So now let me clarify a myth. Which is a myth about, so essentially what I mean here is that having an infinite number of models means that we have the same status as perturbative quantum gravity, which is non-renormalizability. So let me emphasize this point. One myth is to believe that non-renormalizability means that the theory cannot be defined, and it is, you know, essentially. But that's not exactly true. What non-renormalizability means is that, in fact, the theory can be defined, say, perturbatively, to all order in perturbation and made finite. But the price to pay in order to define the theory in that way is that you have to fix an infinite number of infrared observables. So non-renormalizability doesn't mean that the theory is not defined. Non-renormalizability means that the theory has an infinite number of ambiguities. Okay? So essentially what happens is that in a non-renormalizable theory, the UV flow, the renormalization group flow is very, very, very sensitive to all the UV data. So you have to fix all of them in order to determine the theory. Okay? So if you have, essentially, if you have a theory which has an infinite number of ambiguities, then you have a non-renormalizable theory. And because of that, you need the continuum to erase this difference. Okay, so now that we have established that we need to have a continuum, or, you know, argue that we need to have a continuum, let's move to the next slide, which is called bulk continuum. So, okay, so the main issue is, you know, whether we can find a perception to define the continuum of the Simpson model. And there are essentially two main philosophies in this business. One is the renormalization group or refinement approach, and the other one is the GFT or summation approach. And these two approaches differ in how we interpret this two-dimensional complex, which is this extra discrete data. So in the renormalization group approach, we really interpret this two-dimensional complex as a space-time ladder that therefore is a discrete structure we want to get rid of. In the GFT or summation approach, we instead interpret this two complex as a generalized Feynman diagram. And each of these interpretation leads to different approximations. So let me talk about the first approach, which is the randomization group type of continuum. And let me focus first for non-specialists on some version of the randomization group for a spin model or a tensor model. Okay. So when you have a spin model, let's say the square that is, you know, drawn in the middle here, the randomization group can be described in real space as block spin transformation. So what you have is that you need to have not only one lattice, but a family of lattice. Labeled by one, one integer, and that in some sense one lattice is really coarser than the other. So there's a direction, and you can think about one lattice being, you know, a refinement of the other. Okay? So now when you have such a setting, a family of totally ordered lattice like that, then, you know, we can start from, let's say, the fine lattice, which is this four square on the left. Then integrate out all the degrees of freedom that are, you know, inside and all the things that do not contribute to the boundary. Then we get an effective, the first step, you know, we do a block spin transformation, and then we get an effective amplitude or effective action for the bigger lattice spin. Now, when we do that, let's say we start with spin 1/2. If you do that, what happens is that the new amplitude will be not an amplitude for spin 1/2, but will be an amplitude for spin 1. The scene has changed. So then we need some kind of truncation scheme, right, which is the second arrow that says that, well, you know, we have a way to kind of reproject this spin 1 model somehow onto the spin 1/2 model, and then set up a way to describe this procedure of block spin and truncation in a renormalization group setting. Okay. So let's go to the next slide, which is another, you know, example of block spin, which is taken from tensor models. I put it because it's kind of closer to, you know, the type of model we have in L2G. So let's say here it's a model which is all the vertices are trivalent, and the interaction is characterized by a tensor T. Okay, and you can imagine that the index of the tensor is a three legs run from 1 to n. Okay, so the first move on the top side is a move where somehow you change the horizontal TT interaction by some kind of vertical interaction. So we know we can always do that in general, right? We can always, by doing some kind of CG move or recoupling move, we can always change the horizontal line by a vertical one. But if we do that, the speed that is running to run between these two S new interpliners are going to go from not 1 to n, but 1 to n squared. Okay? So when you do such a limitation scheme, usually you want to have a new tensor model, so you find a truncation scheme. And let's say this model is very nice to take as a truncation scheme where you just take the n biggest eigenvalue matrix from L2-5. Okay. So if you have such a truncation scheme, then you can start from the lattice on the left label A, pick a set of edges, you know, where you have this TT interaction, then do this move and truncation, and then, you know, this case is little, you know, triangle around every vertex, and then you just sum them and you get a new model like that. Okay. And that's another, that's just essentially block scheme, but more refined. Yes? Bianca has a question. No, okay, that's why I say. Okay. But essentially, this is the main point here is that, you know, I want to describe the block scheme. The fact that there's two operations involved. One is, and there are different implementations. You know, there's a block scheme. There's all sorts of different implementations. They all have in common the same idea, that one is a coarse-grained move that changes the size of the lattice, and the other one is that you have a truncation. And there are subtle differences of, between, you know, old-fashioned RG flow and the tensor model. But fundamentally, as far as I'm concerned, and at the level for the discussion, they are not really fundamentally, you know, different. It's the same philosophy at play. So the question is whether, you know, this is whether this thing works, or when does that thing work, you know, it's kind of a recipe. So usually a truncation scheme exists, so let's go to the next slide, called RG continuum. So usually a truncation scheme exists only in specific cases. For instance, if the in two dimensions can be shown that if the system is gapped, then the procedure that I just described in the previous slide converge. And what happens is that the success of this procedure always, whether it's this procedure I described in the previous slide or the general procedure of the block scheme, in fact, it goes back to this old idea of Wilson, which is essentially the success of the RG truncation procedure, which is that you coarse grain but you throw out some of the freedom, is essentially due to locality. Okay? So locality means that we have the ability to have a coarse graining procedure that distill out the massive mode. So in the previous procedure, what happened is that there's two types of modes. There's the massive mode that have like very localized excitation, and these are the ones I'm throwing out. And by doing that, I'm making very small mistakes, and then the mistake goes down as I continue the procedure. And so this distillation of the massive mode can be proven to work really well for gaps. So now the main point I want to say is that in spin foam, you know, the flow in general is going to be different from the usual lattice theory normalization. So let's try to emphasize what is common and what is different. So why, you know, am I saying that the spin foam normalization flow is going to be different from the one I just described? And this is the next slide called the spin net RG continuum. So now, one of the differences that we have in networks, which is not in tensor models, so in tensor models or spin models, let's say you take spin 1.5. So the number of spin degrees of freedom is spin. Okay, it's 1 or 2 or 3 or a finite number. And it's usually small. And then we restrict this number of spin to have a small value. Okay. The second difference is that in usual lattice theory, we have some kind of background structure. So we have a set of lattice which is equipped with a total order, right? And this is the existence of this total order among lattices that allow us to have a sense of direction, a sense of flow from bigger to smaller, or coarser to finer. Now, this linear order on the lattice is related, can be interpreted as a change of scale. When you go from one lattice to another, then you can think of each individual block as having some kind of fixed volume or fixed scale, and therefore changing the lattice, the number of steps in the lattice, is really controlled by one scale parameter, by changing the overarching scale that you look at this lattice at. Okay. So now, one of the puzzle of spin form is that there's no preferred, we don't have a background structure, and there's no preferred total order. We only have a partial order, which leads to an infinite number of possible coarse grains. Let's go and see the next slide, called the same thing, spin nets and RG continuum. So in spin form, we only have a partial order. It's pretty clear because we are, you know, a priori the cycles to complex include all possible triangulation or all possible to our, if you want, n balance, you know, object, all possible cellular decomposition of space time. So, and it's related to the fact that there's no natural background structure, so we cannot really think of these complexes, you know, living on a fixed metric and use this metric for putting a scale. So in general, if we take any two random two complex, there's no, it's not possible to say which one is finer or which one is coarser, or it's, you know, there's no total order on this set of two complex. So this means that we don't have a priori a sense of scale or a sense of the RG direction. Okay. So we could say, okay, well, one naive attempt is to say, well, it doesn't matter, I'm going to choose a subset of cellular decomposition that has this total order and study the spin from a normalization group on this. And we should definitely do that. And while we do that, we should worry about certain things. So now, if we choose a particular order and study the spin form RG on it, the problem, of course, let's go to the next slide for spin nets and RG continuum again. So let's choose a subset of cellular decomposition which have a total order and study the spin form for normalization group. The first problem is that, of course, there's a priori an infinite number of such possible choices. Okay? So you could choose square arrays, or parallel arrays, or triangular arrays, or any, I don't know, time order arrays. So we have many, many, you know, many, many ways to choose the random ladders in space with different total orders. Okay, so one hope, or one myth, is that, okay, and maybe it's the fact that in this approach, we have to hope that there's some kind of universality. That is, we have to hope that no matter, let's say, the type of total order we choose, and since we have an infinite number of ways to use total order, at the end of the day, when we take the limit, we are going to get, you know, always the same limit. So the question is whether this is plausible, and it's a very hard question. And we can look at what happens in the usual system. And in the usual system, it is sometimes true, but sometimes it is not true. So the notion of universality is not always. This is another myth. A typical
question. Ron, isn't the issue, and I agree roughly with what you're saying, but there's another way to put the issue, which is that in lattice spin system or lattice gauge theory, the cutoff scale or the lattice spacing is a parameter in Lagrangian or the Hamiltonian. So it's not just that it's convenient to pick square lattices and put a total order on them. The total order is represented by the lattice spacing, which is a parameter of the dynamical Lagrangian or Hamiltonian, whereas there is no such parameter, there is no such cutoff-dependent or scale-dependent lattice spacing in a spin pole model.
Yeah, it's hard to hear you, but I think I agree with your point. It seems to me that was my previous point, that in a system where you have an Hamiltonian or background structure, it's kind of natural to choose an order. But here I'm looking at the other options. Okay, we don't have an Hamiltonian, but let's try to do it anyway. And let's see, let's hope that it works. And here, I don't know. Okay, so I'm saying, it looks arbitrary, but maybe it can work. I hope I answered your question, from what I understood, I agree with you. So I wanted to emphasize this idea of universality. You have to be very careful with this because, there's no general overarching theorem. It's a very complicated setting. So one example where it's clearly non-universal would be if you take a spin system, but which have an anti-ferromagnetic interaction, okay? And let's say I take an anti-ferromagnet on a square lattice, and then I renormalize that, then I'm going to get some kind of solid, with maybe some spin waves, but that's all. Now, if I take the same lattice on a Kagome lattice, that is, I'm going to get a very, 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 very different continuum theory. What happens is that on the Kagome lattice, because the system is frustrated, the system is not frustrated on a square lattice, but it's frustrated on a Kagome lattice, then essentially this system, instead of having a very few numbers of degrees of freedom that contributes to the vacua and that survive in the limit, then I now have a macroscopic order number of degrees of freedom which are of mass less, which means I have as many order, you can count here, if n is the number of sites, then I have n over 3 numbers of vacua states, which is absolutely humongous. Okay, and so it's a kind of a quantum liquid, which is very, very different property. So here it's tied up with frustration. So if you have, and if I have spins which are spin 1, then there's way more possibility of vectors of translation. If I spin n, then there's many different vectors of translation. And of course here what I'm playing with is that an antiferromagnet is not gas, right? So all I was saying before about algae flow having a nice behavior when the system is gapped, but if I frustration, it's not gapped, and when it's not gapped, all these things about universality might not be true. Okay, so that's a word of caution. Okay, when people talk about universality, you have to be careful. You have to be careful, and in spin systems, you have to worry about frustration. Let's go to the next slide. So, to conclude on universality, called universality. So, the ability to prove universality, that is, that your system, has the same limit, no matter what is the topology of your directed limit you're taking in your space of graph, relies on the possibility to split the tensors of excitation into massless and massive modes. Now, the massive modes are eliminated by the algae flow. This is the distillation. And this is the thing you control. And the massless mode survives, and their effective behavior, is controlled in the limit by this fundamental scale. And that's how usually you get this universal algae flow. Okay. So now, in what I just emphasized before is that you have to be careful because in frustrated systems, the splitting between massive and massless is not universal. It depends on the type of lattices you're working on. Okay. So now, the challenge for spinform and tensor models in this approach is somehow to give evidence that for the spinform models we like in a given truncation, RG truncation scheme, we can argue for universal splitting between massless and massive modes in a theory where we don't have a background H. So this is a typo here. It says in a theory with a background H. I mean in a theory without a background H. So the problem in spinform is that we don't have, I think this was these points in the beginning, we don't have a background H that we can work with in the beginning. So And usually when we do this speaking and we prove the RG flow, we really use this background age, kind of this mass from matter. It doesn't mean that, you know, it's not possible, but it means that, you know, we have to somehow bring forward this. So the reliance on this universality means people would rely on somehow bringing out the existence of such an age that allow us to speak massive and massive. So, okay. So that's one challenge due to somehow the fact that the field is arbitrarily large and we don't have a priori age. Now, and maybe this can be done too, and it's interesting to try to get there. Now, there's an extra challenge for spin form, which I already mentioned, is that the spin is itself a scale in quantum gravity. So the spin here is a distance, whereas in sensor models, the distance is built in, you know, it's an external object built in the model. So in our case, the spin is a scale, and the spin is a dynamical variable. Okay, so let's move to the next slide. So it provides, there's the next question that since any understanding of RG is an understanding of locality and how things flow when I change the scale, then it's a crucial question to understand whether there exists a notion of locality or, you know, for spinform models that drive, that control this RG. So let me emphasize another fundamental difference between spin and tensor models. Is that in spin and tensor models, the number of spin variables, I call it D here, but in general I would call it N, is fixed. Okay, you fix it, it's spin 1/2, it's spin 1/2, and you're done. Now, when it's spin 1, whereas in spin form, then the number of spin you put there, you know, varies. Okay, and in fact, it varies a lot because it goes from 0, and the maximum value we put on the spin is usually the infrared cutoff of space. That is, it's the ratio of the cosmological scale divided by the Planck scale. So it's extremely, extremely large, something. So essentially, that's one of the key differences. Finite number of spin versus an infinite number of spin. Now, because in tensor model we have the spin is fixed to be, let's say, 1 or 1/2, then there's clearly a link between the number of building blocks that, you know, the number of building blocks of the spin system can be identified with the scale of it. And in spin form, it is utterly impossible, right? Because we have this issue that one building block, if I take one big four simplex and I take an infinite J on it, then this object is going to be of macroscopical size, right? So clearly the number of objects and the scale, that is the size of the triangulation they support, are very different objects in spin form models. Okay, so I hope this is clear. In lattice model, every lattice site is supposed to be a Planck length, let's say. So when I have n lattice site, then I have an object with n Planck length, and then I take n to infinity, I have a big object. Now in spin form, even if I have n lattice site, n vertex, it could still be, and n is very small, it could still be my object is very big because the spin on it could be arbitrarily large. Okay? So in other words, in spin form, S, we have two parameters which are totally independent a priori. One is the number of building blocks, and the other one is somehow the average spin per building block. Okay? That could vary independently, and unlike tensor models, spin models, these are, you know, unrelated. So, let's go to the next slide called proper RG for spin form. So in the spin form S, we have two parameters. N is the number of building blocks and G is the average spin per building block. Somehow, N is the number of building blocks and G is the size of these building blocks. So now the definition of RG for spin form should be, that's the main point I want to make here, should be formulated in terms of these two scales. So let's go back to the what type of limit we usually consider. So let's say the limit I've been considering, I've described so far, which I call the usual lattice continuum limit, is a limit where, it's the following limit, where n, being the number of building blocks, is tend to infinity, while j, the spin per building block, is a constant. And in fact, this constant practically is related to the volume in lattice uniform. Okay? So the usual lattice continuum limit is the limit where you send n, if we introduce these two parameters, n and j, where you send n to infinity and j is a constant. Now it's interesting to look at the other limit, which we also consider in another part of the literature, which is the semi-classical limit. In the semi-classical limit, what we do is that, you know, we fix n, so we keep the discretization, but we send j to infinity. And what I want to argue is that it's clear that none of these limits is really adapted for simple, okay? The usual naive Lattice continuum limits or the semi-classical limits are not going to give us what we want for simple. What we want instead is a limit that merges the two. So we want to have a limit that is somehow a combination of the two. We want a limit where we send n to infinity. This is a continuum limit, but where also at the same time somehow we also rescale the spin to infinity in such a way that a ratio of them, you know, like the, if you think about it, 4DJ is as the length of an area, okay, like an area. So you want somehow that the volume per unit object is constant. So we will give you that the J to the power of D over 2, where D is the dimension over N, is sent to a constant. This is what I call the spin form continuum. Let's go to the next slide, which is called hydrodynamic limit. So this spin form continuum limit a priori seems weird because it means that the building block that I'm using, if I'm sending J to infinity, is infinitely large. Okay? Whereas usually it's commonly naively thought that if you want to take a continuum limit, you have to take a limit where the building block is infinitely small, always long-term. Okay? So this limit is not of that type. But in fact, there is in physics a setting where we exactly do that. This is called the hydrodynamical limit. And here I'm citing a Landau-Lipschitz. So in hydrodynamics, what we do is that we think of a fluid as made of particles, right? And these particles, from the point of view of the fluid, are point-like objects. Okay? And then we use this continuum structure of point-like objects and point-like flow to describe hydrodynamics. Now, if we zoom in and look at what is this point-like fluid particle, I like this quote by Landau-Lipschitz, you know, that says that any small element in the fluid, this particle fluid, is always supposed to be so large that it still contains a very great number of molecules. Accordingly, when we speak of infinitely small elements of volume, we should always mean those which are physically infinitely small, very small compared to the volume of the body under consideration. But extremely large compared to the distance between the molecules. Okay? So what it means is that when we took the hydrodynamical limit, the particle element, which is an infinitesimal fluid element, is in fact a macroscopical object from the molecular point of view. And the size of this object is the mean free path, which is way bigger than the molecular distance. Okay? So this is what's represented there in this drawing, and in some sense, this is you know, what happens, what we should do in the spin form continuum. So in the spin form continuum, taking n to infinity means that we have to go to a limit where the fluid particle is point-like. Like from the point of view of the bulk, every vertex is very small, but from the microscopical point of view, every vertex is very big because j is n to infinity. Okay. So let's go to the next slide called hydrodynamic limit again, which reproduces this double scaling limit. So it's a double, you know, spin form. I propose that the spin form limit should be this double scaling limit. What's interesting about this double scaling limit is that there's evidence. So we got there by an RG argument. But what's also interesting is that there is evidence that this limit is also exactly the limit in which the flatness feature spin form model discovered by Kaminsky and Hellman is appear. And this is, you know, Muxin-Han has studied this. I think it's partially due to results with Muxin-Han, which has studied this hydrodynamical limit only in the context where n is fixed on a fixed ladder. Okay. What happens is that, in fact, the difference between this limit and the naive limit is that in this limit, we demand the building blocks to have very small curvature, but not very small volume. Okay. That's the main thing. Okay. Let's go to the next slide, partial RG. So now, if we put together the main feature, I think the spin form has two main features. One is the fact that the spin is a dynamical scale. And the other one is the what we emphasize too is the fluctuating nature of the lattice, the fact that there's no preferred total order. So these two together suggest modifications of the RG flow. So you know, the naive RG flow might not be the way to go, but there may be a modification of the RG flow that follows and that takes into account these two natures. And what happens in spin flow model, let's go to the next move for coarse graining moves. It's interesting to see that in 4D trainability spin flow model, we have two types of moves. So coarse graining moves, or let's say refinement moves. So let me here, one move is drawn. It's a 1-5 move. Okay, so I take a one vertex, and then I blow it up in terms of 5 vertex. So this move is clearly a coarse graining move. If I keep doing moves like that, I can clearly tell which one is bigger than the other. The 2-4 move is less clear why, I put it in a coarse graining move, but let's put it, there's some evidence, there's some reason why it's put it in a coarse graining move. So let's say 1-5 and 2-4 would be coarse graining move, where the number of building blocks increase. But now, okay, there's another type of move that we can do in triangulation in order to get all possible triangulation is a 3-3 move. It's a move that doesn't change the number of building blocks. And it has this weird looking form drawn in the bottom here, where somehow you have a triangle and then, there's external legs attached to it. All the time, every vertex has 5, balancing 5. And then you bundle up the top vertex into one and the bottom into one, and then you change the internal connection on the triangle. Okay. So the idea is that maybe we should take this difference, let's go to the next slide, this structure of the lack of partial or the lack of total order symptom seriously, and we should treat somehow differently. We should have a different procedure between refining modes and mixing modes. So maybe we should treat the refining modes in terms of some kind of RG implementation, okay? While the while the mixing modes might be treated in a different manner, either new techniques or in terms of formation. Now suppose that we do that, and suppose that let's say, because we find a way to implement the coarse graining move, or 1-5, let's say, and then 2-2. The 1-5 under study here by Nibida, Jen, and Dundersky, and the challenge is to find a consistent RG implementation. So suppose we study that and we find a way somehow to find the fixed point of this object. So that is, that it might be possible to implement some kind of RG flow on the coarse graining move. So what we will get is some procedure where either exactly or approximately we get new vertex weights, after this position, which are invariant under 1-5 and 2-4, but not invariant under 3-3. Okay? So this entangles these things about, if we had a theory which is invariant in 1-5, 2-4, and 3-3, we have a topological model. And we clearly don't want to have a topological. So now, a very nice result of Dietrich and Steinow shows that, they emphasize that it's possible, so here I said one loop, but it shows that it's possible at zero loop to have invariants of the Reggie action in the 1-5 and 2-4. In their context, I think at one loop they have a difference. We have a result with Aristide where we use a linear Reggie action where we show that in fact it's exact at one loop. But the question is whether, in some sense, we could somehow continue this series and find an improvement of the Reggie action or an improvement of the amplitude such that it is true under all loop, at all loop level. Let's say that at all loop we have an invariance in the 1-5 and 2-4. So somehow the elementary building block is itself continuous. Okay. The reason for that, for this possibility to be realized, is the fact that if you think about it, 1-5 and 2-4 represent pretty flat state vectors in the theory. So in some sense, there's nothing really going on when you do this refinement move. You're just replacing a piece of flat space by another piece of flat space without introducing any really new degrees of freedom. So there might be a way there should be a way to see that at the renormalization of black. Let's go to the next slide, called RG and symmetry. And this brings one of the last theme of renormalization group, which is that, as I said, 1, 5, and 2, 4 represent the flat space vectors. So we should be able to renormalize them exactly. So this is suggested by the old idea that there should be a link between exact six point amplitude and amplitude respecting the box symmetry. This is an idea that, appears in that PCB context of improvement of action and quest for perfect action. It appeared also in the context of Reg J model, as a number was the one proposing that somehow we should improve the Reg J model by the symmetry. And then it was suggested by us in the info model in the context of 3D gravity, where we showed that in 3D the perfect amplitude, that the one which respects the symmetry, is the fifth point amplitude. And recently, Dietrich and Ehn are trying to extend this idea and make it work more efficiently for more simple models. So there is this kind of other theme that somehow there's maybe another way to get information about the fixed point and the origin is that it's about understanding the symmetry of this model. Let's go to the next slide. And it looks like my time is up. So, because it's 11, so I'm not sure what you want to do. The next series of slides talks about summation and what we do in a model with summation. But we need some directions. Do you need me to conclude, or do you want me to go through the Hollywood technique, around 15, 20 minutes? With the chair. Any direction from the chair? Hello?
Yeah, why don't you continue, Laura? Those of us who are interested will stay. Those of us who have other things to do might leave, but I think this is very interesting, so
I mean, we should have
maybe
some questions,
you can take another
though.
10 minutes or so.
We should have some questions before people leave, though.
But I want to be clear. Yeah, I'm sorry. I wanted to lay down. I mean, I thought of preparing a short talk to have a long discussion, but as you see, there's just lots going on. And So
why don't you take 10 more minutes, and then we can still have some time for discussion?
Okay. Yeah, because it would be. I mean, I don't want to be the only one talking about it. It would be interesting to have a discussion about it. But okay. So the other option is summation. Going back to the original problem, we want to define an amplitude independent of the two complex. So an even more natural and simple proposal is just to sum over two complexes, right? With a specific measure. So we can define Z gamma as being the sum over all two complex with a measure called MS of Z gamma S. And that gets rid of the problem. So now it's interesting to note that if the set of objects you sum over that I call T here possess a total order, then taking the infinite sum limit is the same as taking the refinement. Okay, because then you can just bundle them up into one. But if this set of objects T does not have a total order, summing is a widely different concept than refining. Okay? And then the question that you want to ask is that what kind of measure, is going to give you the continuum? Okay. So let's go to the next slide, summation and GFP, and the bullet point here is that the remarkable feature of spin form models is that the summation over all spin form amplitudes can be recast in terms of the group field theory called GFP. Here, for a point of history, I want to give credit to Roberto De Pietri. I mean, if you all use GFP, whoever used GFP in tensor model and group theory, it should be indebted to Roberto. Roberto was the first one. I mean, we wrote this paper with Roberto and Carlo, but I remember the day Roberto was the first one. We knew about Boulatov's models, and Roberto was the first one to suggest that, in fact, the Barrett-Crane model was also implementable in terms of GFP. And then, to our surprise, we managed to see it is. And then there's beautiful work by Reisenberger and Rovelli that show that it's possible for any system. So thanks, Roberto, for that idea. So now, a similar property that essentially any tensor model, you know, a summation of a tensor model can be implemented, is due to Ambior, Ambior independently than Bulatov and the PSU. And this is a very remarkable feature, I find, something I still don't deeply understand, I feel, the fact that you can always have this auxiliary theory that suggests a new way to discuss the continuum. So in the GFC point of view, the field, the GFC field is a field that depends on B group elements, okay, where B is the dimension of the space-time. And in tensor field, it's the tensor that depends on B index, and this index are just going from 1 to n. So next slide. So let me just say something about GFC. So, okay, your GFC at the classical level depends on coupling constants. So let's say here I'm writing the action of the GFC. It depends on coupling constant J, and there's a kinetic term K, okay, phi K minus 1, phi, and then there's a potential term that depends on this coupling constant. Good. Now, in GFC, what's beautiful is that you switch boundary states gamma, switch spin networks, you can assign a tensor functional or, you know, GFC functional or gamma phi. Okay, so if you give me a graph, then there's a natural observable associated with this graph, which is a polynomial observable in the field. Okay, and now the spin from amplitude is simply defined in terms of taking the integral over all phi, exponential minus the action, and taking the expectation value of this operator. Now, in order to define this expectation value, I have to introduce a new parameter that is not part of the classical action that I call, for lack of a better word, a loop counting parameter, which is lambda. And lambda appears as some kind of classical H bar here. Right? So the weight is exponential minus S divided by lambda. Okay. So the GFC depends on two types of data, a coupling constant and a loop counting parameter. And the beauty is that once you give this prescription given down, it's done. There's no more discretization dependence at all. The amplitude I get depends on gamma. That's it. It's done. This seems it is a radically simpler and more compact formulation than Argin, because this can be done in one go. So this explains the fascination with this proposal, because it is extremely direct and simple and powerful. Okay, so now let me go to the next slide, where I say in the title that summing is very different from refining. To let's say, transfer, you know. So the summation is not the same thing as refining. And let me try to explain. That's a very important point where, you know, we understand the differences between GFC type of continuum unit and refinement type. And we have to know this difference because there's a myth that maybe they're the same unit. So once we define the limits like that, we want to understand what is the relationship with the usual approach, the refinement approach. And in one sense, this is the continuum. Okay, this is okay. Here it looks like a trick. You know, I did a big problem and then I just introduced this integral and it's done. It's gone. Okay, so now the main thing is that if you think about the refinement limit aims at computing the physical scalar product. This is what Lee was referring in the beginning, that is the amplitude you're computing should be invariant under DFEOs and should be invariant under the Hamiltonian constraints. So for instance, you know, suppose I split my boundary graph into in graph, gamma star, and out graph, then, you know, in the refinement limit, if I'm successful and I have the right theory, in some sense I should reproduce the quantum symmetry. So I should find an operator H in such a way that the amplitude Z gamma acting on H gamma vanish. Okay, so it means that this scalar product of the refinement continuum is going to have a kernel, and this kernel is representing the symmetry. Okay, so the kernel of the continuum theory is generated by the Hamiltonian constraint. Now, one key point, which I think, you know, I made long time ago, 10 years ago, but seems to not have been really percolated yet, is that the amplitude you get from the GFT, Z gamma, is strictly positive. It possesses absolutely no kernel. So it cannot be a physical scalar product. Okay? This was a point I made 10 years ago, and recently Thomas Seaman has a work where he makes the same point, essentially in a kind of slightly different context, maybe without being aware of this result, but it's a different argument. And it's clear why. It's that, it's just the fact that we have this loop counting parameter that changes the nature of the propagator we use. So it's analogous to the fact that, in field theory, we have the Adamar propagator, which is a projector onto physical states, which imposes the constraint, and then the Feynman propagator. But the Feynman propagator, as it's written here, is invertible, right? It's just it's the inverse of the kinetic term. It has no kernel. Okay, let's go to the next slide. So the next slide is also that summing is very different from refining. And so the main statement here is repeated, the fact that these amplitudes here do not possess any kernel. Okay? There's no operator in it that can be identified with the emission constraints which annihilate these amplitudes. What you can do on your end is very interesting to understand, okay, well, how close am I from having an Hamiltonian constraint? And you can divide, I'm not going to go into details, but you can divide using Schwinger-Dyson theory, an Hamiltonian operator in this theory, which is such that when I compute the amplitude of GST with this Hamiltonian operator acting on gamma, I don't find zero. But what I'm going to find, like in the Feynman case, is something proportional to my GFT H bar, if you want, to my loop counting parameter, okay, which I design lambda. So I'm going to find something proportional to lambda. And what's interesting when you look at this, and then the things that multiply this lambda that I call T and D, both of them, what's interesting is that they correspond to topology change. So they correspond to operators that change the topology of the boundary. So for instance, they change the genus, so they disconnect the operator. So on the right-hand side, this connection change, I mean topology change. Okay. So the difference is, of course, that in GFT, when we do the refinement limit of the Hamiltonian version, we fix the topology of the slice, right? Whereas in the GFT, because we're summing over all these diagrams, we do change the topology of the slice. And somehow the lack of vanishing of the Hamiltonian is proportional to this topology change. So now, this term was first, identified by me, the topology change. The first term was identified by me. It's a term which says, so in this topology change, it can be split into two contributions. One is the handle addition. So essentially, you have a slice, and you add a handle on it, like a tori, and then you glue a tori on it, and that changes the topology of the boundary. What Valentin Bosman noticed is that, in fact, which I neglected in the first one, because it appears only in very degenerate cases, is that there's another topology change that appears which is very degenerate, which is a disconnection change. Somehow you cut your boundary in two and then you get two objects. Okay? But this can be possible only when there's a throat in my boundary which is of Plancken size. Okay. So essentially what this slide shows is that unless I send lambda to zero, unless I send my loop counting parameter to zero, the GFT gamma cannot be equal to the loop quantum gravity gamma, right? It cannot give me the projector on the physical. It gives me something more general that includes also all possible, and maybe better, maybe more interesting, but it gives me something different, which also includes all possible topology change of the boundary topology. Let's go to the next slide, which describes results in GFT tensor model. So, one key development that has been led to numerous progress is due to Radvan Guru, which has first promoted GFT to a tensor field to color tensor. So he assigned some extra coloring to the field, and this change somehow allows to keep easily track of where are the phases, the bubble, and of the two complexes that the GFT generates, and led to lots of, new technical possibility of counting. Okay. And then he proposed the fact that we should look at tensor models in the large N limit. And this has been studied by many, many people, and I'm sorry I didn't put the list of them, but let's say the main actors in the beginning were Razvan, Rivato, Valentin, and then others here. So what is proposed here is to study these tensor models where, okay, first we look at extending the size of the sensor to infinity. So n here is the size of the sensor. Now, when we send the size of the sensor, we have to do two things. I have to tell you, what do I do with the coupling constant, and what do I do with the loop counting parameter? So the larger limit is that what you do with the coupling constant is that you send them to some kind of constant, or in fact, you send them to zero as n to the power minus d, where d is an actual degree that you can assign to a possible GFT operator. And this was the contribution of Razvan, I feel, first, that identified that there is this notion of degrees associated with operators. So you send g, you know, d is equal to zero, okay, if g is a constant, but if d is bigger than zero, then, you know, you send it to zero, and the degree is always positive. At the same time, you should send the loop counting parameter to zero, okay? So this is why large n limit is somehow integrable, because it's a semi-classical limit, right? The loop counting parameter is also a scaling where the loop parameter goes. So it's kind of semi-classical. Let's go to the next slide. So where I summarize large n limit, and there's a remarkable series of results. For instance, a dominance of spherical topology can show that the contribution that dominates also selects the topology of the manifold here, the F3. Another remarkable result is criticality, which essentially expresses this limit is a continuum limit. It contains an infinite sum of discrete geometry. So this is really a continuum limit in that sense. And it contains also universality, that is, it's somehow independent, the challenge we were having for RG, it's independent on the type of potential you're using and the type of limit you're having. And there is some non-perturbative completion of this construction. This is an absolutely remarkable set of results. But, of course, there's a but. Let's go to the next slide. All of these limits describe totally degenerate or compound geometry. Okay. And what it means is that none of this limit or none of this model is really suited for quantum or as a quantum gravity model. Okay. So let's go to the next slide where I explain really what I mean by that. So,
Laura, sorry, I mean, it's 11:20, so maybe...
Okay, let me...
Just tell us the summary of the EMT models and then the total summary.
Okay, so I'm not going to explain why, you know, why it's not suited. Essentially, the main point is that we need to go to GFT model. We need to have a spin to inflate this... So the last spin limit is essentially we get geometries which have an infinite... Let's go to the larger limit slide. Slide 38, geometry is an infinite number of cells but zero volume. And we should use the last spin limit, which are geometries with a few cells but infinite volume, and use the two together. So we need to study GFT models. So let's go to the slide GFT. In GFT models, we have lots of results, and most of them concern renormalizability or, you know, finiteness from models. Even closed equations, there's a remarkable result by Dean Guzman Samari that I recommend. Let's go to the second slide for GFT. Slide 40. Okay, listen, the bullet point here is that what these studies of GFT have shown is that these GFT somehow are renormalizable. If they're renormalizable, because there is, as we have already said, you know, each time you have an RG flow, you have a notion of locality. It means that there's a built-in notion of locality in GFT. Okay? And this is what, you know, Vincent Rivasso always emphasized, and it's true, it has been shown by many, many, many workers there. So the issue is that the GFT, the feature is that the GFT locality is, however, a locality momentum space, which selects the most local interactions in terms of the group. Okay? And this GFT locality has, however, no a priori link to the usual notion of locality in a given space-time. In fact, if you think about the GFT locality that says that things are local in momentum space, in the G space, it is related to the largest space-time scan. So this duality between the GFT locality and the space-time locality that we'd like to have is, in my view, one of the most fascinating and one of the most puzzling points of the whole GFT program. Okay, I won't talk about perturbative extension. And let's go to the synthesis, first slide, synthesis. So the main point here is that spin forms are radically different due to the presence of two things, fluctuating lattices and dynamical spacetime scale. These are the two main features of spinform that we need to incorporate, and I don't think spinform is going to be solved by just simply transposing or recycling old ideas. We need new methods. There are new and exciting developments, but we need more. And I've proposed some, directions for the solution that we should use a combination of techniques in the development, refinement, transformation, and some classes. I don't think it can be done without some kind of numerical effort. And then the last slide on synthesis, is, a summary of some of the things I've proposed that, we should it suggests that the problem needs a mixture of coarse graining techniques with summation techniques. There's somehow a notion of hydrodynamical limits which merge the continuity with the semi-classical limits is suited, and that it's going to be crucial to understand the role of symmetry and its play, its interplay with RG flow. Thanks a lot, I'm sorry for being too long.
For questions? So I have a rather elementary question. I always thought of the spin network on the boundary as a spatial slice of the two-dimensional complex. In what sense, then, could I possibly take the limit of the complex without taking the limit of the spin network?
Let's say in the GFT case, this is what you do. You compute the limit of the boundary is the limit where the limit of the bulk is the limit where you send the number of bulk vertices to infinity. But it doesn't mean that this series is not coupled to a boundary which has finite vertices. So you can have a coupling to this. You can have a very, very, very large number of internal vertex with a very low number of boundary vertices.
But that would be kind of discontinuous, right?
Not really. Imagine go to the particle case. In the particle case, you can have Feynman diagram. Let's look at an XR example, which you're familiar with. I can have a Feynman diagram with very few number of external particles, let's say two, but an infinite number of internal vertices, right?
Yeah.
So this is the, and we usually, we deal with this kind of limits in Feynman diagram, so it's no different than that.
Okay.
Okay. I would like to reply to Jorge's question. Can I? Hello, can you hear me?
Sorry, not very well. Can you change something about the micro? Anyway, there was a comment here.
Yes, let me make my comments. Your idea of partial renormalization and distinguishing the refining moves from the mixing moves, I have two comments about. One of them is that the mixing moves look like gravitational waves. They're shear. They involve what looks like shear naively, whereas the other ones change the volume, which is not the gravitational degrees of freedom. So it makes sense physically to distinguish between them. The second comment is that this is reminiscent to me of the Kramer-Kahn use of Hiding algebras, or the use of Hiding algebras the way Fotini tried very naively a long time ago on spin foams, and because the antipode of the Hiding algebra would act very differently on the refining moves, like the 5-to-1 move, than it would act on the mixing moves. I wonder if going back to this old idea of Hiding algebra, classifying the renormalization of the diagrams might be helpful to define what you mean by partial renormalization groups.
I think we got your first comment, but we could not hear properly the second comment.
Okay, well, maybe I'll just make it to you privately.
Okay.
So now let me make it just very quickly that it might be useful to use the idea of the Kramer-Kahn algebra, the Heiting algebra, to systematize what the distinction you need between the mixing moves and the refining moves to define a partial renormalization group.
Oh yeah, you're saying that there might be algebraic structure or things that people have studied which allow. Yeah. I think when I say about new techniques, I think we need to maybe borrow or just. Yeah, it might be. Yeah, I'd like to know more about this.
I agree. Okay.
Laura, this is Abhay. Just a couple of comments and questions. During the first part of the talk, when you were talking about renormalization, you know, group flow, we said that one might want to actually. Take the refinement limit, and then there are many, many ways, I mean, uncountable ways, actually, of actually doing this refinement limit. And therefore, you know, there's ambiguity. And I completely agree with you. But I think that's true in constructive quantum field theory also, right? I mean, in constructive quantum field theory, there is no canonical way of actually finding the final measure on the space of histories. Even in Euclidean space. So people sort of put an ultraviolet cutoff, infrared cutoff, take a limit in a certain way, and so on. So I think it's not so bad to consider, for example, a directed, I mean, in other words, try to impose an order from instead of just having a partial order. Consider refinement, for example, just consider that simplicial decomposition in which you just refine the number of simplices in some prescribed manner. Because at the moment, the question is really, does such a limit exist at all? And I don't particularly find that bad to just make a choice and some mathematically controlled choice and see if the limit exists. And then after that, one can worry about universality classes. After all, even in ordinary lattice case theory, right? I mean, one just uses cubical lattices. There was an idea that one should use random lattices. And that, in fact, is more compatible with Lorentz invariants and such things. But it never went anywhere.
I agree with, let me comment on this first, and then you put it in a second, maybe. And I mean, I agree with that, that I didn't want to say that we should not do that. I think this is one rule. And you know, it would be absolutely remarkable if we, taking that route and one particular model, somebody comes in and adds that pentagonal lattice, whatever it is, where it can be done and it works very nicely, it would be absolutely remarkable. I'm pointing out to the fact that you have to be aware that in the case of lattice gauge theory, it does work. This is what people do. But you have to be aware that it also does work because the system is gapped and there is an Hamiltonian. So, you know, there are reasons a priori why you believe these things are going to work. So I'm pointing out towards maybe a set of questions that say, if you want to do that, then maybe before just shooting an arrow in the dark and trying to do it, there may be a way when you're successful. You might want to ask other sets of questions. In what sense is there an anything? In what sense is there a gapping, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't want to say we should not go there. I think here the problem is completely open. I mean, this is what I wanted to do in my thesis, and we need a combination of techniques. And any information is welcome. But I just wanted to maybe redirect I think we have to renormalize a bit the naive hope. Some of the things work in the usual system for a specific reason. We do not have a priori these reasons in spin forms. Maybe they are there, but it would be nice to give some arguments in favor.
We are in complete agreement. The second question was about the hydrodynamic limit. I didn't completely understand the analogies. So in the case of the hydrodynamic limit in the Landau scorecard that you had, right? So there were molecules, and there were kind of infinitesimal, but so to say, macroscopic volume elements, and then there was a whole fluid. So this idea that there should be an in-between scale has been around for a long time, right? Even in before spin forms, even in loop quantum gravity, when Arno Salman was talking about staircase problem, and Thomas and many other people wrote a lot of papers about semi-classical limits in that, at the kinematical level. there, one also knew that there should be sort of a scale which is in between, and they called it kind of square root of the Planck length times the length that you are really kind of physically interested in, macroscopic length that you are physically interested in. So this idea, I agree that there should be some in-between scale that is coming up. But how it translates to the specific limits you were talking about, which is really J going to infinity, N going to infinity, etc., that is not completely clear to me. So I would think that the analogy of the molecular separation would be J, right? Would be Planck length or J. And we don't want that to go to infinity. We want, so to say, infinite number of molecules or large number of molecules in the infinite, in the infinitesimal volume element.
Okay, so there are many questions in your question. The first one about the hydrodynamic limit is just that you said it, that there's an intermediate scale. There's a molecular scale, there's the intermediate scale, which is the mean free path. And then there's the global scale. And the ratio of any two of these scales is going to infinity or zero. Okay? So it means that a particle of fluid is already an infinite volume. It contains an infinite number of particles. That's the hydrodynamic approximation. So I was making an analogy in the sense that, so you mentioned it's true that this limit was already appearing in the case of boundary spin form. Here, a boundary spin network, which I didn't mention. Here, what I was saying is that it appears in the case of spin form. So in the case of spin form, we have this kind of tension and duality between two different approaches. One where people focus on looking at the semi-classical limit. And if you look at the semi-classical limit, we have to take J equal to zero. And some people say, well, why would you take that? Because it means that the object is very big. Okay. The point I'm making is that it's okay that the object is very big in the large J limit equal zero because its curvature is very small. Okay? It has a very, very small curvature. In fact, it's flat. So the hydrodynamic limit is a limit where you take the macroscopic field to a very low variation. So in our case, if you take the macroscopic field to be the curvature and you demand the object to be such that the particle of the energy of the particle of fluid has very low variation, you're going to look for a limit where its curvature is very small. Okay? And it's just a remark, a simple remark, that having zero curvature is very different from having zero volume. So you can have zero curvature and infinite volume in some sense. Flat space is such an example. And for me, it's kind of it's a way to reconcile these two themes of work which are happening today in the field. One was focused on the large J limit, and one was focused on the large N limit. I think both of them are, in some sense, getting some key information, and that the solution should come in merging together. Now, the detail of this merging, is to be known for the future, and this is a proposal to reconcile somehow the field and somehow. I truly believe this is where the solution is going to come from. We need to have, it doesn't matter that these objects are large. What matters is that these objects are very low curvature. Curvature do not vary.
Okay. So, but just to make sure that we all understand your sort of intuition, so you want to take this limit such that J to the D by 2 by N is a constant. So, and that constant is very small. Is that correct, my?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. This is the one which is going to be this intermediate scale that you want to be small compared to the macroscopic scale. Yeah. And the proposal, I mean, part of this thing is that the renormalization group should tell you what is exactly the functional relation you should have between J and N. Okay. The one I wrote is the naive one, but we know that the naive relation is always modified by the odds. So yeah, there is a small scale. It's somehow, so that the effective volume of this object is small, but in Planck units, so in compared to macroscopic units, you want to take a limit where the volume is small. But compared to Planck units, you want to take a limit where this volume is infinite.
Yeah, thank
that's,
you very much.
Okay. Don't get a remark.
So I think many issues which Laurent addressed We have actually positive indications.
Is it possible to get closer to the microphone?
So many of the issues which Laurent raised in the first part of the talk can be actually addressed. And so one thing is that I want to clarify that tensor network methods, which are like methods, are actually not just bulk refinement, but they also provide automatically a boundary refinement. And that this is actually a very good thing because it tells you what are the convenient boundary states. So it gives you automatically convenient boundary states and does not depend on this, you know, belief which you put in that spin networks a priori are good for this. Whereas if you only refine the bulk, if you draw it, as maybe the Horace confusion also comes about, is that what you get is that it's a boundary, near the boundary, you get very degenerate simplices. So what that's a bit dangerous because there are some results that at least classically this prevents diffeomorphism symmetry to emerge in the continuum limit if you have very thin simplices. And so diffeomorphism symmetry in this respect is of course important because we hope that this gives you actually triangulation invariance so that these problems which you have in ordering and defining and having thousands of ways of defining differently do not matter in the end.
That's great, Bianca. So does it, but what happens? I mean, the boundary state is still a spin network state, right? It is not that it's some completely, it's so refined that it is like a continuum state in some ways, which is outside the spin network Hilbert space.
Yeah, so there might be two things happening. Typically, what we, if you have a phase transition, then what usually people associate with phase transition is also a change of inner product in at least an infinite system. So the example is your product, Ashtika, you know, the Ashtika Lewandowski Hilbert space, which rather is very convenient if you are in a so-called high temperature or in QCD language confining phase. The F theory, for instance, is much more suited if you have another BF vacuum. So what these tensor network methods give you is basically these embedding maps, which now replace the Ashtika-Lewandowski embedding, and tell you how you should, you know, relate spin networks of different refinement scales to each other. So there's a consistency there which then has to hold us for the amplitude. That basically all what happens is that if you have a notion to refine a core spin network into a spin network which is physically equivalent but which lives on a finer graph.
Maybe to clarify, I mean, and to the point of Bianca and maybe Abai would try. I mean, this was the point in my beginning. I wanted to say, for me, I wanted to differentiate, let's say, tensor network type of proposal, where at the same time that you refine the bulk, you have to refine the boundary, because this is the usual lattice system. And therefore, this is the point of view where you treat spin network as a discretization, okay? So I wanted to differentiate that point of view, which is a valid point of view, from another point of view, which I find it more powerful, which is really the LQG point of view. So in my view, LQG is different from that. It says that the Hilbert space, you know, and the boundary labeled by this boundary graph is already a continuum. It's a continuum expression. It's a discrete basis of a continuum space. Now, the question, I think, which is raised here is whether, you know, it is possible to use LQG, that is to have this preferred basis of state, and then draw results from that or not. And I think the debate is out, and some people have different feeling about it. One hope I have, which might be proven wrong, is that the LQG intuition is proven right. That is, there is an actual truncation, and not discretization, but a truncation of the Hilbert space. Okay. If it is not proven to be true, in my view, this will render the whole LQG program less interesting or less powerful. So I hope this is true. Whether it is or not is really, you know.
I agree, Rana. So the question really was to Bianca, that it doesn't really matter what the precise syllabus space structure is. If, in fact, at the end of the day, this refinement leads you to some states on the boundary, and the question was really, do these states still continue to display discrete geometry? You know, because it may be that the all measure is actually addressed, and those things can easily happen, and there's nothing sacred about it. But I think what is more sacred is really this fundamental discreteness. If, in fact, by these refinement procedures, the fundamental discreteness just disappears, then I think what you were saying just now, Laurent, that it really takes the the oxygen away from the LQG ideas. So the question to Bianca is that after the procedures that they have looked at, in which the boundary states are also kind of refined, and the Hilbert space there changes, does some fundamental discreteness still survive or not?
So Abhay, yes. So these methods, in the end, they just generalize the Arshtika-Lewandowski phenomenon consistency construction. Two other notions of phenomenon consistency, and these notions always allow you to do the same thing, because the repeat phases, to express your dynamics. And so it's only a question, what is the most convenient phase? So there's always this kind of discreteness, and this kind of discreteness, I disagree that it is different from the formality, because exactly as before, it's only an auxiliary discreteness, which will still basically have a continuum Hilbert space in all these cases. Just that you change basically the Hilbert space, this might be more convenient if you want to really represent geometry, and then all these things will come in, these states come in, and so on. So that's just, you can say it's a change of phases, but sometimes it also happens to change the inner product. So the second comment the second question of you was, is there some fundamental discreteness? And so this is more maybe about the spectra of the geometrical operator. And indeed, that is a good question, and depends on this point on the physical, on your intuition. So we have to check what happens in the BF phase, for instance. We have a new BF vacuum. So what happens is that actually there's still some kind of discreteness. It seems to be a bit different. And if you speak of geometric operators,